The crimes, the criminals, why did they do it? Who got hurt? Did they meet justice or commit the perfect crime? You'll find all the clues at Jim Harold's Crime Scene. Well, welcome to the Crime Scene. I'm Jim Harold. Thank you so much for being a Plus member of our Paranormal Plus Club. And one of the most interesting things that I've had an opportunity to do since we've launched this club a few months back is this notion of a true crime podcast, talking about these cases because they're certainly chilling, a fascinating study of human nature. And I can't think of a more famous true crime case than that, of course, of Jack the Ripper. So when I ran across the book of our guest tonight, which just came out, I said, we have to have this man on the show if he'll agree to it. And he was gracious enough to do so. I'm talking about Robert House. He has studied Jack the Ripper murders for a decade, and he's one of the world's foremost experts on the subject, and specifically the suspect, Aaron Kosminski. In 2004, Robert discovered his birth certificate, Kosminski's birth certificate in Poland, and then traveled there and London to continue his research. He's published multiple articles on Kosminski, and in addition to being a writer, he is an artist and a graphic designer. His new book on the subject just out, I believe May 3rd it was, Jack the Ripper and the Case for Scotland Yard's Prime Suspect. Robert House, welcome to the Crime Scene.
Thank you.
So I have to ask, what certainly many people over history have been fascinated with Jack the Ripper. What drew you into this case?
I guess I got interested in Jack the Ripper mainly just because it was, you know, it's one of the most famous unsolved mysteries really of all time. Certainly one of the top two or three unsolved murder cases. I can't think of another one that's more famous. And I think, you know, it was really just the allure of trying to solve the case that drew me into it. I originally read several books on the subject, and I was particularly intrigued with this suspect, Aaron Kosminski, because he had been dismissed as a viable suspect, I guess, by a few authors. And I, didn't agree with the reasons for which he was dismissed, generally speaking. So I started to do some additional research on him and found some, stuff that nobody had found before. And the more I've researched him, the more I'm convinced that, he is certainly, in my opinion, the top suspect in the case. And, there's a good chance that he was Jack the Ripper.
Let's step back a little bit before we get into Kosminski and his profile and why you think he's such a right fit for this this heinous killer. Why do you think the Jack the Ripper case has stood the test of time like this and drawn people in for over 100 years? Well, what is it about this particular case that fascinates generation after generation?
Like I said, it's an unsolved case. Jack the Ripper, by modern standards, is certainly not one of the most prolific serial killers. He actually only killed about, five or six victims. But at the time, Jack the Ripper is often referred to as the first serial killer. That's certainly not true, but it was the first widely publicized case, really, and that's largely because newspapers at that time had just become, widely published, and so it was really the introduction to the concept of a serial killer for people around the world. The case was, reported in newspapers all over the world. I think part of the reason it's stood the test of time is that there's sort of a almost romantic mystique to the Jack the Ripper murders, because people think about the atmosphere of Victorian London with its dark, gaslit streets and the the idea of fog and this, you know, killer sort of walking around the streets. You know, I think that there's something alluring about the time period, perhaps, you know. And yeah, I think that's about it.
So we have this fascination with Jack the Ripper, which is very much there. Let's talk about the crimes a little bit, because it's almost become, you know, a catchphrase, something that's, you know, Jack the Ripper is well known, but most people probably don't realize exactly what his crimes were, the breadth of them. So take us back. How many people did he kill again? What type of people did he tend to kill? And how did he tend to kill them?
Okay, so like I said, he wasn't a, you know, the most prolific serial killer. The murders started in August of 1888. And, you know, essentially he killed about, well, most people agree on five victims. I would argue at least six, possibly seven. You know, even by modern standards, he's a very brutal serial killer. He was what the FBI refers to as a post-mortem mutilator, which means that his primary interest really was in, you know, this is going to sound fairly grotesque, but in, you know, mutilating the victims after death. So he killed prostitutes exclusively, and he would kill them fairly swiftly by cutting them across the throat with a knife, and then he would mutilate their bodies, frequently disemboweling them, taking out. He actually took organs away from at least three of the victims, and yeah, so the crimes only spanned a few months. They began in August 1888, and the last generally accepted murder was in November of the same year. So it was really just a few months. And like I said, he killed prostitutes. There was an enormous number of prostitutes in the East End of London at the time. The East End is generally considered to be one of the worst ghettos, slums, in a modern city. There was an enormous amount of poverty, unemployment, alcoholism, crime, prostitution. So yeah, he committed these five murders and then disappeared, really, and you know, was never really heard of again.
Now, let's talk about, and I do want to get to the part with your theory about Kosminski and why he fits the profile. But let's talk about the law enforcement techniques and capabilities of the day with Scotland Yard. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the modern day, everybody watches CSI, and you can see all these forensic clues that can be gathered, DNA and so forth. Really, crime fighting in that era was rather rudimentary, wasn't it?
Yeah, the police obviously, you know, weren't able to do DNA analysis or the forensic analysis of fibers and things like that. And in fact, they weren't even doing fingerprinting at the time. The techniques that the police had were very limited. It was largely a situation where they put a large number of additional police on the street. There were large numbers of plainclothes or undercover detectives on the street at night. And, you know, in a sense, they were trying to catch the Ripper red-handed. You know,
right, in the act.
Yeah, exactly, because that was, you know, that was in a sense their best chance of really getting him. And, you know, despite the large number of additional police and detectives that were you know, hanging around London, and some were even said to be disguised as women, things like that. He sort of slipped in and out of their hands very mysteriously, and so he was never caught. You know, they would rely also on things like witness testimony, informants, you know, that sort of thing. But they, you know, they didn't have any real crime scene analysis or anything like that. So, you know, it was a very difficult situation. And, you know, it was even more difficult because the prostitutes themselves would take him, you know, presumably he, you know, pretended to be a client. And so the victims would take him to some, you know, dark location, an alley somewhere or a dark square where they thought they would be away from the police. And, you know, so that made it even more difficult for the police to catch this guy.
Yeah, it almost would be the perfect killing field for this monster. Now, over the years, there have been a wide range of suspects. I'm thinking about people like Prince Albert Victor and the recent, accusation by Patricia Cornwell that Walter Sickert, a famous painter, committed these crimes. Can you take us through a tour of some of the best-known suspects, and then we can talk about your number one suspect, Aaron Kandisminski.
Sure. So, you know, like I said, there's this idea of Jack the Ripper as a, you know, for example, you can find a Jack the Ripper Halloween costume, and he's normally wearing a top hat. He's got some kind of cape or, you know, suit, frequently carrying a black bag. You know, so there was this general sort of myth that evolved over the years of Jack the Ripper being a, you know, sort of an upper class type person, you know, an aristocrat or somebody connected with the royal family. So, you know, to a large extent, you know, most of the people who seriously study the case generally don't believe in that sort of thing, but I think that that idea has sort of played into some of the more popular theories that have been presented over the years. So, for example, Patricia Cornwell suggested, you know, this famous painter, Joseph Sickert, was Jack the Ripper. And, you know, that would sort of fit into this, you know, what I think of as the myth of Jack the Ripper. Another popular suspect was this guy whose name was William Gull, who was the surgeon to the royal family. And that theory was presented in a movie called From Hell, starring Johnny Depp. So these are the, you know, these are the types of theories that are probably most commonly known by the general public. You know, it's been suggested that Jack the Ripper was possibly a member of the royal family, like you said, Prince Eddie. Another theory was that Jack the Ripper was a Mason and that his crimes, you know, exhibited characteristics that, you know, had Masonic symbols. And another theory has been that Jack the Ripper was a doctor because some of the doctors who performed autopsies and who testified at the time believed that Jack the Ripper may have actually had some sort of anatomical knowledge because of the fact that he, you know, cut out and removed organs. There was debate over that at the time. So some of the doctors believed that. Others said, you know, they didn't believe that he had anatomical knowledge. But that has been another, you know, sort of idea that's persisted over the years. You know, it's interesting because it's really in stark contrast to my idea of what Jack the Ripper was probably like, because, you know, and this agrees, in fact, with the American FBI's profile of Jack the Ripper, which they did in the 1980s, you know, which the idea was that Jack the Ripper was probably a, you know, a resident of the East End, which means he was probably poor. He was a local, and you know, in all likelihood, he was a fairly average person. He wasn't an aristocrat at all. You know, he's just a common sort of lower class resident of the East End.
And so we bring to the idea here of Aaron Kandisminski, your suspect number one. Can you talk about who Aaron Kosminski was and what his upbringing was and the situation they grew out of, because I think that that may have a lot to play into his stories later.
Aaron Kosminski was, he was a Jewish immigrant from Poland. At the time, in fact, when he was born, Poland was a part of Russia. So the country actually technically didn't exist at that point. But he was born in 1865. And, you know, in all probability, he was, he grew up fairly poor. Now, there's actually, unfortunately, not a huge amount that's known about Aaron Kosminski's upbringing, specifically, you know, in terms of the quality of his family life or things like that. His father died when he was very young, and he, his mother, in fact, was quite old when he was born. I think she was in her 50s. And he had several brothers and sisters. At the time, it was really a difficult situation for Jewish people in Russia, because there was a large amount of anti-Semitism and distrust of the Jewish residents by both you know, the Russian peasants and also by the you know, the aristocracy and the, you know, the people in power in Russia, really. And, you know, the Jews lived in fairly, deplorable and difficult, environment. In, 1881, the Tsar of Russia was assassinated, and, he was assassinated by some, you know, a sort of an anarchist group. You know, it was a politically motivated assassination. And the Jews were kind of scapegoated and blamed for the murder, wrongly, by, you know, a couple of newspapers, for example, that speculated that Jews had, you know, been behind the assassination. In any case, it became widely, you know, believed that, you know, Jewish people may have been involved in the assassination. And what happened was, shortly after the assassination of the Tsar, there was an outbreak of what was called pogroms, really means, you know, very large scale rioting against the Jews in several cities, in the western part of Russia. You know, and these were really fairly vicious. Jewish residences were ransacked, burned down, looted. There were several murders reported, rapes of women. You know, they were really quite brutal. And this led to a mass exodus of Jewish residents from Russia, departing for Western countries. A large percentage ended up going to America, and you know, thousands, tens of thousands really emigrated to London. And so Aaron Kosminski was among, you know, those who emigrated from Russia. At the time, he would have been, let's see, 16 years old. And, you know, so they ended up in, you know, this very poor part of the city in London. There were a lot of, you know, there was a good deal of anti-Semitism in London at the time also. And so, you know, in a sense, the way I thought about it was kind of like an out of the frying pan into the fire type of situation, where he may have perceived that, you know, they had just sort of escaped from, you know, this rather horrible situation, and then ended up in a, you know, a situation in London that was sort of a mirror image of that. The anti-Semitism in London actually increased over the decade, and it was very interesting to me to find out that you know, the increase in anti-Jewish feeling in the east of London really peaked just around the time that the Jack the Ripper murders began. So, you know, I sort of speculate in my book that, you know, when you're talking about the psychological underpinnings of this person who's a suspect, it's, you know, very well possible that it was some sort of lashing out against society, possibly for, feelings of being treated unfairly and,
right,
you know, being unfairly scapegoated and things like that.
So Kosminski goes to London and he possibly commits these murders as a reaction to things that had been possibly done to his family, possibly done to him, certainly done to his people. Why does he stop?
Before I answer that, I just want to clarify, I sort of speculated that these situations that I just referred to may have had something to do with, the reasons why he became a serial killer. But I certainly would not say that that's the only reason. It's really not known much about him. Like I said, very little is known about his family upbringing or the quality of his family life. And people who study serial killers often, theorize that these fantasies of committing murder are, rooted in some deep, deep psychological, something that happened to the person when they were younger or something like that. So I can't really say that that's the only reason. I just wonder if it's a factor.
Right. And I think it's very clear. You're not in any way, even if, these terrible things happened and it may have contributed to his mindset, I don't think anybody would ever, if in fact, I don't even think you're saying it is, I think you're saying it is a possibility, but even if these things did drive someone in part to do these things, that's still no excuse for doing these horrible things.
No, absolutely not. So to get back to your other question about why the murder stopped, again, that's not really known, but, one possibility is that he may have stopped killing because he was aware that, the police were sort of watching him. He became a suspect at some point. We don't know exactly when that was. The police, almost certainly would have questioned him. They probably questioned members of his family. And one thing we do know is that they were keeping him under surveillance. So it's entirely possible that he stopped killing just because he sort of knew the police were on to him. And, that's one possibility. I can't say for sure.
Now, how keyed in were the police on him? I think somewhere I read that you say that the greatest portion, or it's been said that a great portion of Scotland Yard believed he was the murderer. How keyed in were they on him? And if they were so focused on him, why did they step back and not pursue it further?
It's not really clear how many people believed that Aaron Kosminski was Jack the Ripper. The main person who believed that he was Jack the Ripper was the guy who was essentially the head of Scotland Yard's criminal CID, which is sort of the equivalent of the American FBI. This is the Assistant Commissioner of Police, Robert Anderson, who said flat out that there was no doubt whatsoever as to the identity of the murderer. And, he quite clearly was referring to Aaron Kosminski when he said this. His subordinate, this guy who worked beneath him at the yard, was a guy named Donald Swanson, and he was the person who was in overall charge of the Jack the Ripper investigation specifically. And if you read what he wrote about Aaron Kosminski, well, he does not say with the degree of certainty that Anderson did that Kosminski was definitely the Ripper. He seems to generally imply that, he believed Kosminski was probably a strong suspect. There were, you know, there were probably other people at Scotland Yard who, you know, thought Kosminski was, you know, perhaps the top suspect in the case. But apparently what happened was that, you know, they probably had a certain amount of evidence against him. One of the main pieces of evidence they had against him was a witness who identified him as being, you know, the person, person who was seen at one of the crime scenes just, you know, a matter of minutes before one of the murders took place. This person unfortunately refused to testify in court. They probably had additional evidence against him in the form of, you know, testimony by perhaps people who suspected him. They probably gained some information by interviewing him himself. But whatever they had, according to Anderson, who was the assistant commissioner, it was insufficient to get a conviction, legally speaking. In other words, the you know, whatever evidence they had, it would not be enough to get a conviction in court. So, you know, despite this, Anderson says there was no doubt that this guy was Jack the Ripper, but he knew that they didn't really have a case, legally speaking. So, you know, they were kind of in a bind, really, I think, and there was nothing they could do legally against him.
And what was his life like after the killing stopped? How did he live out the rest of his life that's known?
Well, Aaron Kosminski was schizophrenic, probably. At the time, the you know, the actual definition of these mental illnesses was, you know, kind of defined a little bit differently. So his asylum records don't specifically say he was schizophrenic. In fact, his asylum records diagnosed him as having mania. But if you read the symptoms, it seems fairly clear that he was schizophrenic. He probably started, you know, losing his mind sometime around the mid to later part of the 1880s. It's not known exactly what, you know, what state of mind he was in 1888 when the murders occurred. But by 1890, he was brought to a place called Mile End Old Town Workhouse to, you know, to be assessed regarding his mental state. And at the time, he was released. And it's probably, although it's not certain, but it's probably after he was released that he was kept under surveillance by the police. So, and it's also probably at this time that he was identified by the witness. He then was, you know, he was back living at his brother's house in Whitechapel for approximately 6 months. And then he was brought back to the workhouse, the same workhouse. He was legally deemed insane, and then he was entered into Colney Hatch County Lunatic Asylum. And 3 years later, he was transferred to a place called Leaves Den Asylum for Imbeciles. And he stayed there for the rest of his life, and he died in 1919. So this is quite a few years after the murders. It's you know, it's about 30 years after the murders that he died at age 54. But when the murders occurred, he was quite young. He was 24, I believe.
Yeah, that's it's very chilling just to think that you know, he went on living and certainly probably did not have a good life, but the Jack the Ripper lived for all those many years after that. Now, your book, it had to be quite a thrill to have a foreword written by Roy Hazelwood, who is a pioneer FBI profiler. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. Roy Hazelwood, he's a great guy. He's a very nice, friendly, you know, guy. And, you know, I was thrilled to have him, you know, both write the foreword to my book and, you know, also just answer, you know, several questions that I had about serial killers in general. You know, he's a very knowledgeable person on that topic. The FBI conducted interviews with a large number of serial killers. And, you know, this really kind of informed, you know, the modern understanding of serial murders, both in the sense of what makes a person become a serial killer and also, you know, what serial killers are like generally. So like I said before, Jack the Ripper was this type of killer called a post-mortem mutilator. They also use the term lust murderer, which basically means the same thing. It's a person who, you know, is interested in mutilating the body after death. So Roy Hazelwood actually had written an article for an FBI bulletin in, I believe, in 1980, in which he discussed this type of killer. So I wanted to, you know, sort of pick his brain about that. And, you know, one thing he told me that was very interesting, that was, to my knowledge, never revealed before, although the FBI's profile of Jack the Ripper has been, you know, sort of in the public realm for many years. One thing that was not included in the profile was that Roy Hazelwood believed that Jack the Ripper was, in fact, schizophrenic because of the, you know, because of the, you know, the nature of the crimes, and, you know, because of the fact that they had looked at other similar killers who did similar types of things, and they were frequently, you know, psychotic, schizophrenic.
Yeah, I think that's that speaks volumes that you'd be able to get him to do the foreword. So that's kudos to you. How is the book doing? I mean, I just came out last week as we taped this. What has been the reaction?
The reaction has been pretty positive so far. I get the impression that some of the people in the what I would call the Ripper community are kind of excited about it. It just came out about a week ago, and it's coming out in England in a few weeks from now. So those people over there haven't had a chance to, you know, get it yet. But yeah, the reaction's been pretty positive generally.
Oh, great. Well, I'm glad you made that distinction because we have listeners all over the world, and that's one of the neat things about this. So we definitely have a very strong contingent in the UK, so I'm glad that you mentioned that. If folks want to go and find out more about Robert House, about what you do, about this book and so forth, where can they go on the net?
Well, one thing I'd say is that if you want to find out more about Jack the Ripper, generally speaking, there's a great website that's got a huge amount of information that's called casebook.org. And it's got information about all the murders. It's got links to the inquest testimony, newspaper articles. There's message boards that are, you know, extremely active. And you know, there's a community of people who are frequently referred to as Ripperologists who are, you know, just obsessed with the case, constantly talking about it. So you can find, you know, all that stuff there. And if you want to find out about me, well, I have a website, which is roberthouse.com, that has a link to, you know, a link to the Amazon page where essentially you can buy the book. But you can, and it also has some of the photos I took in London of, you know, the way the crime scenes look in the modern day. But yeah, the book, you know, the book's available on Amazon. It's available on Amazon in the UK or, you know, any of the other major book selling websites.
Well, Robert House, thank you so much for writing the book and for being on the crime scene tonight. It is a fascinating topic that has fascinated us for over a century, and I suspect a century from now there'll be a couple of people talking about it on whatever they call a podcast in 2111. Thank you so much for being on the crime scene.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jim. I enjoyed it.
And thank you for signing up to the Paranormal Plus Club. We'll have more great content. We'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.